What book are we on, Tom?
Oh, 1 Samuel.
Still.
Yeah, I'm still there, still plugging right. away. Okay, let's pick up where we left off in the 26th chapter of 1 Samuel. And this is basically a continuation of what's happening to David in terms of his constant fleeing from Saul. And like I had mentioned last week, and I think even a week before that, in terms of how God is really training David, and he's really fashioning and shaping him and molding him in this wilderness experience. In a sense, I mean, if we are going to commit our life to God, I mean, we're all going to have a wilderness experience one way, shape, or form or another, because we're going to have to be trained. We're going to have to be brought up and brought through, some very difficult times in our life. I mean, it says in the book of Isaiah, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. It's not if you will, but when you will. I mean, we're all going to go through the reamer one way, shape, or form or the other, because it's like, what do we need? We need discipline in our life. We really do need to be disciplined. We need to be brought up and trained by God himself, and he will use trials and tribulations and disappointments and heartbreaks and disillusionments and these type of things to fashion and shape and mold us into people that really begin to reflect the image of his son. That's what he's looking for. It would be really nice if he could just zap us at our conversion and we'd be changed, where we'd never have to go through all these difficult experiences. But it says in Isaiah 55, God's thoughts aren't our thoughts and his ways aren't our ways. And this is the way God does things. And it tells us in Hebrews that I think it's Hebrews 12, that every son that God receives, he disciplines, he chastises, he chastens, he builds up. Because this is what we need. Because like I said, we all are born sinners. That's our problem. We're born sinners, okay? We're not sinners because we sin. I mean, we sin because we're sinners. Now, I'm going to repeat that because I think it went over half of your people's heads, okay? We're not sinners because we sin. We sin because we're sinners. We're born sinners. That's the bottom line. Of course, most people today revolt at that very thought. Most people today think, well, I'm basically good. If there's a heaven, I'll get there. No. If you really see it from God's perspective, you see, hey, man, this is the way we are. And this is why we really do need to be fashioned and shaped and molded by the hands of God and fashioned into images of Christ once we accept him. And it's not easy, because God will use the hammer, he will use the saw, he will use the jackhammer, the dynamite, he will use the polisher, the grinder. I mean, he will use all of these different things that are very unpleasant in our life to draw us closer to him. That's what he's doing to David in David's wilderness experience. And like I said before, you look at all the people in the Bible that have wilderness experiences. I don't care whether it's John the Baptist or Jesus himself, or you go back to Moses or go back to Joseph or any number of people that God has used mightily. The truth is, I can't think of an exception where God, his hand hasn't been heavy upon someone who he has desired to use greatly. It's doubtful whether God can use a man greatly or a woman greatly until he's hurt them deeply. And I know I'm kind of rambling here, but I'm kind of setting the stage for this because we're getting into a couple of chapters tonight that I think some people have a real difficult time with, no doubt in my mind, because of some of the things that are going to transpire, especially in chapter 27, where people are going to be annihilated. Whole cities and towns are going to be annihilated. And people, if they're not looking at this clearly and not looking at it from a divine perspective, they can always jump to wrong conclusions. Okay, so anyway, beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 26, it says, now the Zephites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, is not David hiding on the hill of Achilah, which is before Jeshimon? So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen men of Israel to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul camped in the hill country of Achilah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road. And David was staying in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. And David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped, and David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army, and Saul was laying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. Now this Abishai, if we read in 1 Chronicles chapter 2, 15 and 16, we learn that Abishai is David's nephew. And in verse 7 it says, so David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp, and with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the people were lying around him. Then Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" David also said, "As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go." So David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away, but no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because of a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on the top of the mountain at a distance with a large area between them. And David called to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who are you who calls to the king?" So David said to Abner, "Are you not a man, and who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came to destroy the king your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die, because you did not guard your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was at his head." So Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord the king." And he also said, "Why then is my lord pursuing his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Now therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is men, cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today, that I should not have an attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.' Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come to search out a single flea, just as the one hunts a partridge in the mountains." Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool, and I have committed a serious error." And David answered and said, "Behold, the spear of the king. Now let one of your young men come over and take it, and the Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all distress." Then Saul said to David, "Blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Keep a couple things in mind. David is a type of Christ. I mean, I've mentioned this before a number of times, but you look at David, and David's one of the most honored men in Scripture. His name is mentioned like something like 1,100 different times. And even Jesus Christ is often referred to as the Son of David. I mean, he came through that line. But he was a type of Christ, all right? You can see a lot that happened in David's life that was almost like a prefigurement of Jesus. And you see a situation here where every time he seems to get away from Saul, and Saul says that he's not going to pursue him any longer, and Saul is just absolutely consumed with resentment and jealousy and bitterness. I mean, this is a cancer that is eating at his soul. And remember, we went through chapter 24, you know, Saul went into the cave to relieve himself, and there David is in the inner recesses of the cave along with his men, and he had the perfect opportunity to slay Saul right there in the darkness, but he refused to do it. You know, instead he cut off, I guess, a part of his robe, a part of his belt, or whatever part of the rope of his belt or something of his robe. And he demonstrated to Saul back then that, hey, I could have easily taken your life, but I refused to do it because you're the Lord's anointed. Now, I mean, this is speculative on my part, but where do you think he got such a profound sense of a fear when it came to attacking the one that God has anointed or made?
From his own childhood and his
family.
Huh? Well, I'm thinking more in the terms of, you know, David was very familiar, I think, with the writings of Moses. And remember when we went through the 16th chapter of the book of Numbers, and it was there that Korah, Dathan, and Abram stirred up the whole congregation against Moses and Aaron because they felt like, hey, man, who are you guys? You know, who put you in charge over us? You know, who made you leader over us? And they stirred up a lot of discontent among the people, and they said that all the Lord's people are holy. You guys are just loose cannons out here, a couple of renegades just calling all the shots, and nobody put you in charge. And basically, they just started attacking God's anointed, because obviously Moses was anointed of God, and so was Aaron. And they had a very profound mission or job to do, and they were standing in the place of God. But here, what happened? These men became resentful. They became bitter. They became jealous of Moses and Aaron. And so what did they do? They got 250 men, and they said, we're going to bring these men in, and they're going to offer sacrifice or offer incense to God. And then Moses basically said, okay, you do that. You go ahead and do that, and then we'll see who God chooses and who he doesn't choose. And anyway, if you go back and read that whole chapter, I don't have time to read it because it's kind of a lengthy chapter, but it's pretty darn, I think, sobering when you read that chapter and look at what happened to these men who rebelled against God's anointed. These men, Korah, Dathan, and Abram, they stirred up the whole congregation, and then they got to the point where when Moses called them up to the tent of meeting, they wouldn't even come up. They just were being very, very belligerent and defiant and obnoxious, and so Moses goes to their tent, and you know, he says, if these men die a natural death, then you'll know that God has not sent me. In other words, you'll know that God didn't put me over you. But if something totally new happens and the ground opens up and swallows them alive, then you'll know that God has sent me. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, the ground just opened up. Korah, Dathan, and Abram, all their children, all their possessions, everything went down alive into the grave. And the earth closed up over them. And, you know, that must have been a frightening thing to witness. And then the 250 guys who had the censers who were offering this incense to God, fire came out from the Lord and just destroyed them. Because God, you know, these people were rebelling against the authority that God had established. And it was a very, very serious thing. And I think that's where David got this deep sense of respect and fear for, you know, God's anointed. I mean, that's speculative on my part, yeah.
And that's where the incident with Aaron's rod happened just after that.
Yeah, good point. Because right after that, God says, okay, I'm going to tell you what to do. Have all your leaders come up here. And I'm assuming what happened was they had a leader from each tribe bring their staff before God. And he says, put them in the tent of meeting or the tabernacle overnight. And so they all put their staffs there. And I'm assuming there was 12 of them there. And then at the next morning, they brought out the 12 staffs. And Aaron's rod had budded. All he had was a staff. It's like a piece of wood, you know, just this dead part of a tree that he'd used to walk with, a walking staff, and it budded almonds and leaves, which pointed to what?
Life.
It pointed to resurrection. I mean, you're not going to get almonds or leaves out of a dead piece of wood anymore. You can get it out of that dead piece of furniture there. I mean, it's just not going to happen. But what did it show? It showed the resurrection, life coming out of death, and God had them put that rod inside the Ark of the Covenant, along with, remember, the manna and along with the Ten Commandments. And that's where, when they put the lid of that ark on top of that box, they put the lid on top, they had the two angels looking down at what they call the mercy seat, remember? And then that's where the blood would be sprinkled, showing that everywhere that man breaks God's moral laws and everywhere that he spurns God's provisions, like that's why the manna was there, and everywhere that men revolt or dishonor the authority that God has placed over them, that's an offense against God. That's a sin against God. And therefore, it needs to be covered by the blood. Go back to where David has this real deep sense of respect and honor for the authority that God has placed over him. And he's not going to lift his hand against him, even though this man is hell-bent on killing him. You see a tremendous depth in David as far as his spirituality and as far as his trusting in God. Because he had a perfect opportunity again to take Saul's life, but he refused to do it because, hey man, he basically told his nephew, Abishai, he says, you know, you can't stretch out your hand against God's anointed. Look what he says here in that verse 9. He says, but David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? David also said, as the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. Now, what David's doing, he's leaving it into God's hands. He's not forcing it. He's not manipulating. He's not doing any of these such things. He's leaving it in God's hands. That shows a tremendous amount of trust, doesn't it? And you see this in Jesus Christ. He was on that cross, right? And believe me, those nails did not constrain him on that cross. It was his love and his obedience for his Father, his love for his Father, and his love for man. You know, he could have slain all mankind with just a glance. He said it himself, that he could call down legions of angels. But he left it all in God's hands. And just before Christ died, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. You see with David, you see a reflection of Christ, that even though David was in a position, you know, to take vengeance on his enemies, he left it in God's hands, just exactly the way that Christ did. And I think it says a lot. Sometimes, I mean, we can be up against some of the most difficult things in life with people in authority over us, but we always have to have that kind of mindset that, hey, you know what? God put this person in my path for a reason. I mean, I don't know how many people I've dealt with on my job, for example, and I wonder to myself sometimes, where did these people ever get promoted? How, you know, these people couldn't run an outhouse, let alone a supermarket. I just don't get it. I mean, they have no people skills, no emotional quote whatsoever. And yet I do know when they grate me in the wrong way, I think, hey, man, God put them there for a purpose. And he's trying to teach me a lot of things, including humility. So I just got to keep my mouth shut and show the utmost respect and just do my job. All of us are in that situation one way, shape, or form or another. I don't care whether it's with your parents or with your teachers or with the police or with the religious leaders or the civil authorities. You see what I'm saying? We've got to always have that kind of respect. But what's happening today? Everything's disintegrating. Anyway, I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but I think there's a lot to be said here in terms of the way David handled this situation. And like I said, you look at the situation and say, well, where did he get such a deep respect for authority over him? Well, I believe it was because he was so grounded in God's word. And obviously he had some very solid spiritual teaching and upbringing by his parents. But I think, too, that if you look at it, remember David had seven brothers, and when all the brothers passed before the Lord, I mean, the Lord said, these aren't the ones. And he said, the man judges by outward appearance, but God judges the heart. So it's my opinion that even though David had all these brothers, they all had the same kind of upbringing, but David is the one who had a heart for God. I think that's what made all the difference in the world. You could be raised in a religious family and even have parents in the ministry, but it's still your choice. You might not have a heart for God and go the other way, you know. But David wasn't that type of person. I mean, he showed it from day one. But one other thing, too. I think that it's kind of interesting. This Abishai, this his nephew, when David had asked this, he said this in verse 6, and David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. So he goes down with him. And they were taking their lives in their hands, obviously. There's 3,000 guys down there. They know that if anybody sees them, they're as good as dead. But you look at a situation, I mean, I don't want to stretch this too much, but in a way, you look at what's happening to Jesus Christ in this respect. Right now, we're living in this period of time, of course, where Jesus is in heaven, but at the same time, it's like he's living in his rejection right now. In other words, the world's rejecting him. He's the one that said it. I mean, the world hates me, it'll hate you. If it despises him, it despises us. I mean, this is the world we live in. And I think that in this very, very dark time, God is still looking for people who are willing to go down with him to do his work. Just like Abishai was willing to go down with David in this very, very difficult situation, a very, very dangerous situation, and be loyal to him right there in the midst of that, right? Well, you know, that's what it's going to take today. It's going to take a cold, naked, and tender will of people today, if we want to take a stand for Christ, to be able to just dig in our heels and say, you know what, I'm not going along with this program. As a matter of fact, I protest this program because this is what God's Word says about it. Now, what's going to happen to you? We are the ones that are going to be vilified. We are the ones that are going to always be looked at as being the enemy. Just like with Saul. I mean, Saul represents the old man. Saul represents the world. Saul represents our fallen nature. And they just will not have this man, Jesus Christ, reign over them. And they would do everything in their power to try to, you know, bring him down. Well, this is where we live today. Anyway, just in concluding this chapter, David, when he gets to a safe distance away and he's got Saul's spear with him and he's got Saul's water jug with him, then he calls out in the darkness and he calls out to Abner. Now, who remembers who Abner is? Abner is a commander-in-chief of the army. He's Saul's right-hand man. And so, therefore, he's basically a general who's in charge, right? And he's sleeping next to Saul. And it's his responsibility to make sure that the sentries and the guards are fully awake and they're doing their job, but everybody fell asleep because it says here a deep sleep fell upon them from the Lord. The Lord was orchestrating this for David's protection. Well, he rebukes Abner, and then Saul calls out in the darkness and he says, "Is that you, my son David?" And then Saul comes under conviction. And David is basically saying this, "You're running me out of town." Look what David says in that verse 19. He says, "Now therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering." In other words, what he's saying here, if what you're doing is right, if I have wronged you in any way, if God is punishing me in any way for any wrongdoing, then let me offer an offering to God and get right with God about this. And then he says this, "But if it is men, cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods." In other words, if I'm blameless before God, and it's just men that are stirring you up, in other words, there's men that are accusing me of being traitorous or being treacherous or being a danger to you, then let them be cursed. But of course, it wasn't anybody putting this into Saul's ear, saying, "Hey, David needs to be executed because he's a threat to your kingdom." I mean, it all came from Saul himself. But I do believe it came from the powers of darkness, that they're there constantly, stirring up Saul. Because we know that, because we're told earlier that when the Lord had departed from Saul, an evil spirit began to torment Saul. And this is what happens when we get into rebellion and get into disobedience. I mean, the Lord can depart from us, and then we're going to be tormented by demons. Look what happened to this guy here, this Cho. This guy goes out and kills 32 people. You don't think that this guy wasn't driven by demonic forces? That's exactly what happened to the guy. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. Of course, you're not going to read that in the paper. You know, you're going to hear all this psychobabble, and then you're going to hear all this BS about how we need to get rid of guns. But is that the guns that are a problem? What are we told about the first murder? Go all the way back to Genesis and read about what happened to Cain. Cain was becoming more and more infuriated, more and more resentful, more and more jealous, more and more bitter towards his brother Abel, because God was accepting his sacrifices, Abel's sacrifices, where he wasn't accepting Cain's, because Cain was not bringing the proper sacrifice. Well, what did God say to Cain when he was really thinking about killing his brother? What did God say to him?
"Sin is crouching at the door and you must master."
Right. You know, isn't that descriptive? That to me is so descriptive, because it's almost like if somebody's crouching at the door, what does it suggest to you?
That you're sneaky.
Yeah, they're ready to pounce on you, right? They're looking for an opportunity to attack you, to get to you, to bring you down, right? If they're crouching at the door, right? That's what he said, sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Are we living in an insane asylum, you know, that we're always trying to deal with the symptoms instead of the root cause? And the root cause is we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. The root cause is sin, and it's crouching at the door and its desire is for you. You must master it. That's what we're dealing with here. And I know that it's getting off on kind of a tangent here, but when we're reading what's happening to David, he's just saying that these men, let these men be accursed, that they're feeding you with all of this poison. He's telling that to Saul, because what does he say is happening to him? He says that he's being driven out of the land and forced to serve other gods. Look what he says here in that latter part of verse 19. He says, "For they have driven me out today that I should not have an attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods." In other words, they're driving him away from God, because remember, his tabernacle at this particular time was in Shiloh. And that's where they could only offer sacrifices there. So in other words, they forced David to stay away from God because he couldn't fellowship with God's people. We couldn't go down and pray at the tabernacle. We couldn't go down there and offer sacrifices because of Saul. Because of what's happening to him, he's always on the run. Anyway, and just winding it down, what happens to Saul here? That verse 21 says, "And Saul said, I have sinned. Return my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight. Behold, I have played the fool, and I have committed a serious error." Now, again and again, Saul kind of comes to his senses. He sees, you're right, I'm guilty, I've blown it. But then he can't be trusted. And David knows he can't be trusted, so David's not about to go back to serve in his court, because he knows that, you know, he's a marked man. Because You know, this can happen to a lot of people a lot of times. They can come under conviction for their sin in their life and for the rejection of Christ, and they can come under conviction, and then they can confess their sin or apologize to God, but then they go right back to their old ways, right? How many times have you seen this? How many times have I seen it? And Dave, you've probably seen it a lot because you're dealing with all these people that have made complete messes out of their life. They give their life to God, and then they're constantly going back to their old ways, right? I mean, we see this all the time. I think what Saul really needed to do was just humble himself before God and quit trying to have his cake and eat it too. I think if he was really, really genuinely sincere, he would have just simply said, hey man, I abdicate my throne. I'm turning it over to David. I'm no longer going to be king because God has rejected me and I'm turning the whole kingdom over to David. But he wasn't about to do that. Well, you see, that's what people need to do if they're going to really get serious with God. They're going to say, I have to give up my drugs. I have to give up my alcohol. I have to give up, you know, this lifestyle. I have to give up all that. I'm going to give it all up, you know, because I'm going to get serious with God. But Saul, he only kind of gives his half-hearted apology, but he's not about to give up, you know, his throne. He's not about to give it up. So the guy's going to end up having this ignominious defeat, and we're going to get into that next week. But, you know, there's a lot of spiritual applications to be drawn from this. Anyway, just in concluding this, at verse 25, then Saul said to David, thus start you, my son David, you will both accomplish much and surely prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. And so Saul sees it. Saul knows it, okay, that, hey, man, he comes under conviction. He realizes that David is the righteous one and that he's going to lose it all. But like I said, how many people, even though they see the truth of it, they still don't do what's absolutely essential to get right with God and to get right with their fellow man and to get, to, you know, they're going to hang on tenaciously to what? To their sin. They're just not going to let it go, even when they come under conviction. But anyway, just before we get into this chapter 27, look at that verse 23. And David says this, and the Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And David says something here that's very prophetic. He says that the Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and for his faithfulness. That says a lot, doesn't it? That's a theme that just runs from one end of this book to the other. That God is going to someday judge the world. He's going to judge individuals, and there's going to be rewards, and there's going to be punishments. And, it's, you know, he will reward men for their faithfulness and their righteousness, but also for their unfaithfulness and their wickedness. That's the bottom line. Of course, you know, we're not told that today, not even from the pulpits of a lot of churches today, unfortunately, but that's what needs to be said. Anyone have anything you want to add or share before we... Okay, let's just quickly go through this chapter 27 and we'll close for tonight. It says, then David said to himself, now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me anymore in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand. So David arose and crossed over, and he and the 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maoch, the king of Gath. Now, you know what? When I read this, it's very, very difficult for me to accurately judge where David is coming from here, because I think David is making a mistake here. And the reason I think he's making a mistake is this. Remember when a couple of chapters back when we were reading about the men of Keilah who were being attacked, it was in chapter 23, when the people of Keilah were being attacked by the Philistines. And then David basically asked the priest, Abiathar, by using the Urim and the Thummim that was on the ephod. He was basically asking God, should we go up against the Philistines and deliver the men of Keilah? And God said, go. And his men weren't too sure because they said, boy, that doesn't look like that's a really wise idea. So they asked God again, and God said, go. And he says, I will give you the victory. So in other words, he was seeking God, and God gave him the victory, and God allowed him to escape from Saul, even though he went on to deliver his people. And my point is this. There's no mention here in this chapter 27 that David sought God's will in this. Like I said, I don't want to be too judgmental here, and I don't want to be too speculative, but he doesn't appear to have asked God where to go. I think it says a lot, because what happens to him? His logic tells me, well, the only place I could probably be safe is to go into Philistine territory, which is God's enemies. And he figures, if I go there, Saul's not going to pursue me. But it doesn't appear that he prayed about it. In other words, this is the scripture that I live by, but it's Proverbs 3:5. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. Well, when you read this, it appears that David is relying upon his own understanding. Because look what he says here. Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me to do than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Now when Saul, when he says that, he's not seeing clearly. You know, it's very easy for me with this hindsight to see that. But I'm sure that if I was in his position, I would have a hard time seeing it too. But if he would step back and look at this situation objectively, I don't think he would have come to this conclusion. Basically, his conclusion is this: I'm a dead man. Someday Saul's going to kill me. Well, if he stops and thinks about it rationally, wait a minute, David. Didn't Samuel anoint you to be king over Israel? Well, if God anointed you to be king over Israel, Saul's not going to be able to slay you, right? And just make this application in your own life. I mean, how many people are really going through some very, very difficult times right now, and you don't know what God is doing in your life? You're almost despairing of life. You're getting depressed, or you're just feeling like trying to find some form of escape in your life. Well, what we really need to do, I think, is just redouble our efforts in terms of prayer and seeking God's face. Because it doesn't appear that David did this, so he goes into the lands of the Philistines, and what does he do? He goes to Achish, which is he's the king of Gath. Now, remember what happened to him when we read about him when he went to King Achish earlier, I think it was in the 21st chapter, that David tried to escape from Saul the first time there, and he goes to the Philistine territory, and he figures, maybe I can just blend in here, and Saul won't pursue me. Well, people recognized him right away, and they brought him to King Achish, and they said to him, this is David, isn't this is the one who the women sing, that Saul has killed his thousands, but David his 10,000s? And so David realized he was a dead man there. So remember, he feigned being a madman, he feigned insanity, because back in those days, you know, nobody was going to kill an insane person because they felt like he was possessed of an evil spirit. And if they killed an insane person, that evil spirit was going to, you know, possess you. So King Achish just simply said, hey, don't I have enough madmen in my kingdom? Do I need to bring me another one? He says, get this fool out of here. So David escaped with his life. But now he's coming back, I think, a few years later, and he's being totally accepted by this king because David and Saul are having a big falling out. And so he just figures he could really use David, okay, for his own advantage, because the Philistines and the Israelites were sworn enemies, and Saul was the king of Israel, so he was the sworn enemy of Achish. So he accepts David this time around because he figures the word's got out that there's a bounty on David's head by Saul. So he knows that he's not going to be loyal to Saul. So anyway, pick up with that verse 2. So David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men with him, to Achish, the son of Maoch, the king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, and he and his men, each with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam and the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. Now it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. So in other words, David escapes to Gath, he escapes to the Philistines, he brings his wives, and as a matter of fact, if you look at the number of David's wives that David had, I mean, when he was at Gibeah, remember he was given Michal, that was Saul's daughter, and then while he's on the run here, he was given Ahinoam and Abigail, and then he had a wife by the name of Mahlah and Haggith and Abithal and Eglah, and also Bathsheba. And through these different women, he had a number of different sons. We'll get into that more when we get into First and Second Kings. In Second Samuel, rather. But what you see here is that it wasn't just 600 men. It was much more than that. It was the 600 men and most of their household, most of their families that have crossed over. And they're basically, like I said, they're on their run. You know, David's kingdom hasn't been established yet. And that's the way it is with us right now. We're in a wilderness. We're on the run, in a sense. We're in the world, so to speak. And it's not going to be till Christ comes back, sets up his millennial kingdom, you know, that we're going to rule and reign with him. But right now, we've got to basically go outside the camp, so to speak, and bear his shame, just the way David did in this situation. In verse 4, it says, Now it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. Verse 5, then David said to Achish, now if I have found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country, that I may live there, for why should your servant live in the royal city with you? So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And just in passing, this Ziklag, that was at one time conquered by the Israelites. That was their territory. But, of course, because of their own indolence, they lost this city. But now Achish giving David this city for him and his people to live in. And then it says here in that verse 7, and the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. So he's there 16 months. And it says in verse 8, it says, now David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites and the Gizites and the Amalekites, for they were inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you come to Sur, even as far as the land of Egypt. And David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive, and he took away the sheep and the cattle and the donkeys and the camels and the clothing. And then he returned and came to Achish. And now Achish said, where have you made a raid today? And David said, against the Negev of Judah, and against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, and against the Negev of the Kenites. And David did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, at least they should tell about us, saying, so has David done, and so has been his practice all the time that he has lived in the country of the Philistines. So Achish believed David, saying, he has surely made himself an odious among his people, Israel. Therefore, he will become my servant forever. Now, this is the part I think a lot of people might have a lot of difficulty with when they read this situation where David, what's happening to him? He's basically exiled in this city that was given to him. I don't know if you can see it here on this map here, but Ziklag is right around this area right in here. Anyway, long story short, he's going down to the Negev. He's going down south, and he's making all these different raids on these various people. And he's basically killing them, man, woman, and child, and he's taking their livestock and anything of value, and he's bringing it back to Ziklag, and he's also giving kind of tribute to Achish, the king of Gath, or the Philistine king. And so the Philistine king's asking, where are you making all your raids? So he's basically telling them he's making them inside Judah. In other words, he's implying that he's making these raids against God's people, which he isn't. He's actually making these raids against God's enemies, or the enemies of God's people. Now, we don't know, if you look at it here, we don't know who the Geshurites are to this day. And there's not a whole lot said about them, or the Gerzites. But we know a lot about the Amalekites. They were sworn enemies of God. And apparently, the Gershites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites were also enemies against the Philistines. So what David is doing is he's going out there and he's fighting against the enemies of God's people. And he's basically destroying them, you know, totally and completely. Like I said, we may look at this and say, hey, now, you know, this is a lot of useless bloodshed, isn't it? I mean, this seems like a crime against humanity. How could God sanction such a thing that we have men, women, and children that are being wiped out by David? But again, what's happening here? We've got to step back and look at this picture and ask, what's God trying to say to us? What's he trying to tell us? Because this is our tutor and this is our teacher. Well, you go back, remember when we went through the book of Deuteronomy? And this is just one example of many, but when we went through the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 7, God said this. He says, when the Lord your God shall bring you into the land where you are entering to possess it, and shall clear away many nations before you, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater than, stronger than you, and when the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, you shall defeat them, and you shall utterly destroy them, and you shall make no covenant with them or show no favor to them. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them, and you shall not give them your daughters to your sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, and then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy it. And then it goes on, and just simply say, what God is saying to them is that when you go into this land, you destroy every man, woman, and child. Now, we got to ask ourselves, okay, why would God do this? Well, remember, we went back, all the way back to the book of Genesis, and I think it's the 15th chapter, but I think it may be the 15th, 16th, or 17th chapter of Genesis. God said to Abraham very clearly, he says that when the iniquity of the Amorites, or the Canaanites, is complete, then I'm going to bring out your people, and I'm going to give them this land. So in other words, what God is saying is this, when a nation, when a people's iniquity reaches a certain point where it begins to overflow, When the cup of iniquity begins to overflow, then it's time for judgment. And so when David is down there and he's wiping out whole cities of people, it's God executing judgment on these people. Because God told them very plainly that they were supposed to do it way back in the time of Joshua. Now, if the people of Cana were living for God and loving God and serving God, and they weren't involved in all their gross immoral practices and all their idol worship and all of their violence and all their crimes, do you think for 1 minute that God would have had his people go in there and destroy these people? I mean, common sense tells you no. What's happening is these people's iniquity had reached a point of no return. It reached a point where the cup of iniquity was overflowing and there was nothing left for them but judgment. So God is using David, you know, to judge these people. And when David becomes king, he's going to judge a lot more people. You know that Jesus Christ is going to slay more people at one time than all the despots of the world combined have done throughout history. Now, if I would say something of that effect to people, there's no way that they would believe it. They're saying, what are you getting at? And all I'm saying is, you know what? If you go back to the 19th chapter of the book of Revelation, we're talked about Jesus Christ. He comes back. He says in verse 11 in chapter 19 of Revelation, it says, and I saw the heavens open, behold, a white horse, and he who sat upon it is called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and upon his head are many diadems, and he has a name written upon him which no one knows except himself. If there's a name written upon Jesus Christ that nobody knows except him, what does that tell you about him?
He knows everything.
That he's God.
He's infinite.
That he's God. In other words, only, you know what I'm saying? God would know his name. He's God. No one knows his name but him. And what? His eyes are a flame of fire, and he wages and judges war. And this is what it says. And he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood. Why is his robe dipped in blood?
Because he's coming as judge.
Because when he speaks this word against these armies that are going to turn on him, he's going to expunge every last drop of blood out of their veins. His robe is going to be splattered with blood. But it says here, he is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. And from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may smite the nations. And he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh, he has a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I saw an angel standing in the sun. Anyway, it goes on to say, and I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. And we are told what happens when Jesus Christ comes back, and you've got the Battle of Armageddon going on down there. You've got at least 200 million men from the east. You know, you've got China and probably Cambodia and Vietnam and Laos and Japan and maybe India and Pakistan and all these kings of the East. They're down there with an army of 200 million men. Now, you've got from the West probably an army that of equal size, maybe even more. You may have as much as a half a billion people down there. And if the average person has about 6 quarts of blood coursing through their veins and Jesus Christ is going to speak the word and expunge every last drop of blood out of their veins, I mean, we're talking billions of gallons of blood that are going to be spilled. And who's going to spill it? It's going to be Jesus Christ. And it's going to form a river the height of a horse's bridle for 200 miles. So when people read what's happening to David, when he goes out and slays all these people, the fuzzy thinker, the shallow thinker, or the person who's not thinking clearly is not going to see what it's really saying. Because we are told in Corinthians that, hey, the things of God are foolishness to the natural mind. So when we're reading what David does to these people, understand that these people were under judgment. Now, God is constantly pleading for people day in and day out to turn from their wicked ways and be saved. But if they're not going to turn from their wicked ways, then he is going to judge them, okay? And even their children are going to suffer terribly because of the sins of their parents. Now, I'm not saying the children go to hell by any means, but we are told in Corinthians, hey, man, the child is sanctified through the believing parent. If you've got just one believing parent, then if you've got an innocent child who hasn't reached the age of accountability, then he's going to be spared the judgment. See what happens? Look what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. Look what happened in the Noachian flood. Multitudes of little children wiped out.
They didn't go to hell, but they were wiped out because of the sins of their parents. See what I'm saying? You see what this is telling us? Like I said, the shallow thinker, the fuzzy thinker is going to look at this and say, well, God's nothing but a big bully, and David was just a man of bloodshed. But you got to stop and look at it. What was God doing? He was judging these people for their iniquity, for their wickedness, for their evilness. And I'm telling you, 9/11 was a wake-up call. We've been getting so many wake-up calls. This poor, demented soul running around killing 32 people and wounding other people on a Virginia Tech college campus. This is another warning from God. It really is. It's a judgment from God, but it's a warning from God. It's God's mercy saying, you know what? This is another whistle, another siren, another warning, another trumpet sounding the warning, saying, hey, man, we've got to turn from our wicked ways. We've got to turn from our wickedness. Otherwise, this judgment is going to come upon the entire nation. We're going to see 9/11 times 10, times 100, times 1,000, times 10,000. It's coming. And, you know, I don't want to leave on that note, but I'm just simply saying what we're reading here, we got to always put it in a proper context to say, okay, what's God trying to tell us in this situation? Because, like I said, the critic of the Bible is going to read about David doing these things and saying, hey, man, God sanctioned this kind of murder? No, he didn't. But what God did sanction was this kind of judgment. Anybody have any adders here?